Welcome to the Deep Dive. When we think about nuclear safety, our minds often jump straight to, well, the nuclear part, right?
Yeah.
Radiation, core physics.
Yeah, the big dramatic scenarios. And if you follow safety history, you definitely know about the 1975 Brown's Ferry fire, caused by a candle, unbelievably.
Right, a candle check for air leaks. It showed how something totally non-nuclear could threaten safety systems.
Yeah.
A huge lesson for the industry.
Absolutely. That fire reshaped everything about fire protection, cable separation, you name it. But today, we're heading back to Brown's Ferry, but much later for a different kind of threat, an electrical one.
Okay.
We're doing a deep dive into an arc flash incident from 2002. We're using the official licensee event report, LER50296-2002-D0000, as our guide.
An arc flash. So not fire, not radiation, but electricity itself.
Exactly. This LER shows how sometimes the biggest risks aren't these slow burn physics problems. They can be instantaneous, high energy electrical events that pop up during what's supposed to be a safe maintenance period.
Okay, let's get into this. So for you listening, our goal here is to really unpack this. Go beyond just maintenance accident and see the second by second sequence. How does one momentary slip up by a person instantly put the core defenses of a nuclear plant to the test?
Yeah, the LER reads like a minute-by-minute stress test.
And what's the key takeaway we should be listening for?
Well, the immediate human cost was severe. 4 workers injured by this incredibly intense event. But the system impact was huge, too. The flash knocked out critical power boards.
Okay.
Which, and this is crucial, triggered 2 huge emergency diesel generators, EDGs, to automatically start up and take over. Textbook defense in depth response.
And all that triggered by?
By one electrician moving a grounding cable just a few inches too close to an energized part. A tiny movement, massive consequences. It's really a stark lesson in high consequence human performance.
All right, so to grasp how serious this was systemically, we need the context. Where are we? What's the setup?
We're at the Brown's Ferry Nuclear Plant, Northern Alabama. It's run by the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA. Big plant on the Tennessee River.
3 reactors there, right? BWRs.
Yep. 3 General Electric Boiling Water Reactors, BWR-4s, powerful units.
And the specific date and time?
Tuesday, March 26, 2002, late afternoon, around 5.30 p.m. Central Time. And the plant status is key here.
Okay, what was going on?
Unit 3, which is where the trouble starts electrically, wasn't running. It was well into its cycle 10 refueling outage. Specifically, it was in mode 4.
Mode 4? That's cold shutdown.
Exactly. Cold shutdown, reactor stabilized, fuels cooled down. The moderator temp was steady around 188 degrees Fahrenheit. So relatively stable from our reactor physics perspective.
And the other units?
Unit 1 was completely defueled at the time. Unit 2, interestingly, was running full tilt, 100% power, about 3,458 megawatts thermal.
Okay, so Unit 3 is shut down, seems like the safest condition. But you mentioned this outage paradox earlier. Why is an outage potentially more risky, not less?
Right. It feels counterintuitive, doesn't it? But the industry learned the hard way. While the core melt risk, the big one, is way down, other risks actually spike. Industrial risks, electrical risks, systemic risks from all the maintenance activity.
How so?
Well, think about it. During normal operation, the plant's stable, systems are aligned, lots of redundancy is available, often powered by the grid or its own generator.
Makes sense.
But in an outage, you're deliberately messing with that stability. You take safety gear offline for maintenance, so your protective margins get thinner.
You're changing the electrical lineups too, I imagine.
Radically. You might be using temporary power, jumpers, different breakers. Redundancy is often reduced just to get access to equipment. Plus, you've got hundreds of extra people on site, contractors, specialists, all needing to get physically close to potentially high energy gear. It creates this environment where procedural discipline has to be absolutely perfect.
So it's intense industrial work happening right inside the nuclear safety boundary. What exactly were the electricians doing that afternoon?
They were performing a really critical safety task, installing safety grounds.
Safety grounds. Explain those for us.
Sure. They're basically heavy cables that maintenance crews clamp onto equipment that's supposed to be de-energized. They provide a solid path to ground, so if any stray voltage somehow appears, it goes safely to ground instead of through a worker. It's a vital protection.
Okay. And the specific job?
It was part of a larger maintenance clearance, 3057-00001. Big job involved installing 25 sets of these grounds for work on the main generator and turbine breakers during the Unit 3 outage.
And where were they working at this particular moment?
They were focused on the 4.16 kilovolt switchgear. That's medium voltage, but definitely carrying enough power to be lethal. This gear was in the turbine building and feeds some major plant equipment.
Specifically, they were near the cubicle for the 3B unit board breaker, breaker 1314.
That's the spot, breaker 1314. And this location is crucial because that breaker feeds some really important power distribution circuits for unit 3 auxiliaries.
So a routine task for electricians, but performed right next to a significant energy source, demanding absolute precision.
Precisely. That sets the stage for what happened next.
Okay, before we get to the exact error, let's make sure we all understand what an arc flash really is. It sounds bad, but what are the physics? It's not just a spark, right?
Oh, not even close. An arc flash is a catastrophic release of energy. It happens when electrical current literally jumps through the air, forming plasma from one conductor to another, or to ground. Think of it like a contained lightning bolt, but generated by massive fault current from the power system. Thousands of amps.
And the immediate effects are intense.
Intense is an understatement. The LER confirms what we know about these events. It's extreme physics in milliseconds. The temperature of that arc plasma can shoot past 35,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
35,000?
Hotter than the surface of the sun, about four times hotter.
Wow.
That incredible heat instantly vaporizes metal, like copper or aluminum. It expands explosively. You get molten metal shrapnel flying out at high speed.
And it's not just heat. There's force, too.
A massive pressure wave, like an explosion. It generates a deafening sound blast and can physically throw workers. It's this combination, the intense heat, the blast pressure, the molten metal that causes the horrific burns and injuries reported in the LER.
Truly terrifying. Okay, so let's walk through the setup. It's about 5:40 p.m., 17.3 euro CST. The crew is at that 3B unit board breaker cubicle, 1314.
Right. Operations had already done their part. They racked out the breaker, meaning they physically removed it from the cubicle, creating space to work inside.
And the electricians started setting up the grounds.
Yes. They clamped the base of three safety grounds to a grounding strap there on the cubicle floor. Standard practice.
The next step was connecting the other end of those grounds inside the cubicle.
Correct. They needed to attach the connecting rods to the power connection points inside. We call them stabs.
Stabs. Okay, clarify that. And you mentioned high side versus load side.
Sure. Stabs are just the heavy copper or metal bars inside the cubicle where the breaker makes contact. The high side stabs are connected to the incoming power source in this case. They were still energized at 4.16 kilo-UV.
Still lift. Got it.
The load side stabs are where the power would go out if the breaker was closed. Since the breaker was racked out, these should have been de-energized. The whole point of the grounding was to connect these de-energized load side stabs to ground for safety.
Okay. And they checked this. Did they verify which was which?
They did. The LER notes the procedure. An electrician used a voltage detector, a Detex neon voltage detector.
Standard tool.
Yep. They touched it to the high side stabs. The detector lit up, confirmed energized. They touched it to the load side stabs. It did not light up, confirmed de-energized.
Okay. Seems thorough.
They even double-checked the energized high side again before putting the detector down. So procedurally, the energy state verification looked okay.
Which makes what happened at 17.52 CST, just minutes later, so frustrating. The check was done, but something went wrong in the action.
Exactly. The LER points directly to the root cause, personnel error due to inattention to detail and failure to adequately self-check. It wasn't faulty equipment.
So what was the specific error?
The electrician picked up one of the safety ground connecting rods. Instead of carefully placing it onto the de-energized load side stab he intended to ground, he inadvertently moved the rod too close to one of the energized high side stabs.
Too close, meaning the air gap wasn't enough.
Precisely. The voltage was high enough and the distance small enough, the report implies, just inches, maybe less than a foot, that the electricity arced across that air gap to the grounding rod.
And that tiny gap, that momentary lapse,
instantly created that blinding massive arc flashover. One small movement, one failure of focus, and you unleash that 35,000 degree event. It changed everything in that moment.
So the arc flash itself was this localized violent event injuring the workers. But the LER then shifts focus to the plant's systems. What happened electrically, system-wide, in that first second?
The immense current drawn by that arc fault caused what's called a C-phase differential current lockout. It's an automatic protective function.
Like an emergency brake for the electrical system.
Exactly. It's designed to trip instantly to prevent even worse damage from massive fault currents. And this lockout immediately de-energized the source, the 3B 4KV unit board.
Okay. And losing that board, That's significant.
Hugely significant. That 3B unit board is a major power distribution center for Unit 3's auxiliary equipment. Losing it has immediate knock-on effects.
Right. So trace that cascade for us. Losing the 3B board meant...
It immediately cut off the normal power supply to two absolutely critical safety buses. The 3EC and 3ED4KV shutdown boards.
Shutdown boards. They power things needed even when the reactor's offline.
Yes, essential safety systems. Things like the residual heat removal pumps, RHR, and instrumentation you need to safely maintain that cold shutdown condition. Losing power to these boards is a serious event.
So 3EC and 3ED go dark. This must have been the moment the engineered safety features really got tested. I can only imagine the alarms and sounds in the Unit 3 control room right then.
Oh, absolutely. If you were an operator in that control room at 17.52, your world just went from quiet outage monitoring to full-on alert status in a heartbeat. You would have heard it, the unmistakable loud rumble of the emergency diesel generators, EDGs 3C and 3D, automatically starting up.
Because the system detected the loss of power to those shutdown boards.
That's the design. Loss of voltage on those critical buses automatically signals the associated EDGs to start, get up to speed and voltage, and then their output breakers close to repower the boards.
And did they work, the LER says?
Perfectly. The EDGs started as designed, and within seconds, they had closed their breakers and successfully re-energized the 3EC and 3ED shutdown boards. Power was restored to the vital equipment.
That's the defense in depth working right there. Automatic redundant power.
Textbook example. The engineered systems did exactly what they were supposed to do to counter the electrical fault.
But the disruption wasn't just about the power boards and diesels, was it? The control room would have seen reactor protection alarms, too.
Yes, another layer to this. The loss of one of those shutdown boards, the 3C board specifically, also knocked out power to RPS bus B.
RPS, reactor protection system.
Correct. That's the brain, the logic system that monitors the plant and triggers a rapid shutdown if safety limits are crossed. It has two redundant logic channels, A and B.
So losing power to bus B.
It caused an immediate half scram. Since the reactor was already shut down, it didn't mean rods flying in, but the logic registered half of the conditions needed for a full protective scram.
And that half scram signal itself triggers other things.
It does. It kicked off a whole series of automatic isolations via the primary containment isolation system, or PCIS.
PCIS. So valves started closing all over the place. Break down what isolated this shows how widespread the system felt this electrical fault.
Right. The system basically went into a protective posture, even though containment was open and the reactor depressurized. It's following its programming for this kind of electrical event. The LER lists several PCIS groups that actuated.
Okay.
Group one, the main steam isolation valves, the MSIVs, shut, prevents any potential pathway out of the main steam lines. Group two, this was a big one, it isolated the shutdown cooling mode for loop two of the RHR system, specifically pump 3B and closed drain valves in the drywall. So the active cooling loop got temporarily cut off. Group three, isolated the reactor water cleanup system, RWCU, keeps reactor water inventory secure. Group six, this is a big environmental and ventilation group. You saw isolations and system shifts and containment purgement, reactor building ventilation, the standby gas treatment system, and even the control room emergency ventilation. All went to their safer isolated states. Group eight, even some instruments isolated, like the traversing in-core probe system, the two.
Wow, that's a massive number of automatic actions rippling out from that one arc flash in the turbine building switchgear. The operators in the control room must have been facing a sea of flashing lights and alarms.
That's exactly what the LER calls the method of discovery. The alarms associated with the 3B unit board loss hitting the panels.
And their response. How quickly did they react?
The LER indicates the response was prompt and professional. The event happened at 17.52. They immediately confirmed the fault, saw the EDGs had started correctly.
Okay.
By 18.02, just 10 minutes later, operations staff were already working through the procedures, acknowledging the flood of alarms, resetting the RPS and PCIS logic where appropriate, and starting to assess equipment status to bring things back online or into standby.
10 minutes from the flash to starting systematic recovery on potentially dozens of systems?
Yeah.
That's impressive under pressure.
It really highlights their training. And the most critical manual action came shortly after. At 18.07 CST, only 15 minutes after the initial event, they manually started the other RHR pump, the 3D pump, to restore shutdown cooling using the power from the EDG.
So they quickly reestablished that vital cooling function.
Yes. And the NRC's review, documented in the LER, concluded the operators acted appropriately and critically. All the automatic system actuations and isolations happened exactly as they were designed and expected to. The engineering and the humans managed the crisis.
Okay, so systems responded, EDGs ran, operators acted fast. But the big question, especially from a public safety standpoint, was the core safety function preventing fuel damage ever actually jeopardized here? What was the final assessment?
The LER is quite clear on this. Despite the severity of the electrical event and the injuries, the fundamental safety function of Unit 3 was not compromised.
Not compromised, even with the temporary loss of that RHR cooling loop.
Right. Several factors play into that conclusion. First, the plant state. It was in cold shutdown. The amount of decay heat being generated by the fuel was much, much lower than if it had been operating or even recently shut down.
Less heat to deal with. Makes sense.
Second, while, yes, the RHR loop 2 shutdown cooling path was automatically isolated briefly due to that RPSB bus loss,
yeah,
the operators manually restored shutdown cooling using the other RHR pump, 3D, powered by its EDG, within about 15 minutes. They reestablished that heat removal path relatively quickly.
Okay, but that relies on the EDGs working. What if, worst case, both EDGs, 3C, and 3D had failed to start? That's always the scenario people worry about.
And the LER addresses that exact contingency. That's where the defense in depth really shows. Even if both those diesels had failed, which is highly unlikely, the plant still had other ways to manage decay heat.
Okay.
Primarily, the torus, that huge pool of water in the suppression chamber below the reactor and the safety relief valves, SRVs. If the reactor vessel started to heat up and pressurize because RHR wasn't available, the operators could have manually opened the SRVs to vent steam from the reactor vessel directly into the torus water. The torus acts as a massive heat sink, absorbing that energy until other cooling or power could be restored.
So multiple layers of backup, even beyond the EDGs.
Exactly. That's why the event was not considered a safety system functional failure. All the technical specification requirements, the operating rules were ultimately met. The design basis held up.
The engineering worked. But let's bring it back to the start of the whole chain reaction, the root cause. It all came down to that one moment, didn't it?
It did. The engineering backups were essential, but the initiating event was human. The root cause analysis stated it plainly. Personnel error. Specifically, inattention to detail and a failure to adequately self-check during the task execution.
And the detail I found really striking in the report. The electrician involved had already successfully put grounds on four similar breakers right before this one.
That's the human factors trap, isn't it? Repetitive tasks, especially successful ones, can unfortunately breed complacency. You do it right four times, the fifth time feels automatic.
Your guard drops a little.
Maybe just slightly. But in that environment, working with 4.16 kV, where literally inches of clearance separate safety from a massive energy release, that tiny lapse in vigilance, that failure to maintain precise positioning near the energized high side stab, had immediate devastating consequences.
It really drives home that routine work doesn't mean low risk. Discipline is everything.
Absolutely. Every single step, every single time.
The nuclear industry has a mantra, learn from everything. An event like this, even though safety systems ultimately worked, must have led to changes. What did Browns Ferry do immediately on site to prevent this specific error from happening again?
Oh, absolutely. TVA initiated several corrective actions through their internal program. They tackled it from multiple angles, people, procedures, and equipment.
Okay, start with the people and procedures addressing that root cause of human error.
Right. They rolled out targeted retraining for all their electrical maintenance folks. The focus was specifically on the correct methods, the required rigor for applying safety grounds, especially around medium voltage gear.
Reinforcing the basics and the risks.
And importantly, they didn't just retrain. They developed a completely new dedicated TVA procedure just for medium voltage safety grounding. This wasn't just part of a general electrical procedure anymore. It was specific, detailed, likely with very clear steps on confirming clearances, mandatory checks, maybe peer checks, really trying to eliminate ambiguity.
Making the expected standard crystal clear. What about equipment or engineering changes? Anything to physically prevent getting too close?
Yes. A key engineering control they committed to was using test carts more often where appropriate.
Test carts.
Think of it as a piece of equipment that lets you perform tests, like voltage verification and potentially even connect grounds from a safer distance.
Yeah.
It puts a physical barrier or more space between the worker and the energized components, significantly cutting down the chance of an accidental arc flash just by proximity.
So procedural rigor backed up by engineering controls. Now, this wasn't just a Brown's Ferry issue, was it? This event, maybe along with others around that time like Diablo Canyon in 2000, really sent ripples through the whole U.S. nuclear industry regarding electrical safety.
It absolutely did. It was a major wake-up call. It highlighted that vulnerability during outages when you think things are safer because the reactor's down, but your defenses might actually be thinner.
Because redundancy is reduced for the maintenance itself.
Precisely. It forced the industry to stop thinking about electrical safety as just sort of standard industrial safety, separate from nuclear safety. They realized these high-energy electrical events are nuclear safety events because they can directly challenge the plant's protective systems.
And that led to bringing in standards from the broader electrical industry. I'm thinking NFPA 70E.
Exactly the one. NFPA 70E is the standard for electrical safety in the workplace. Before incidents like this, its application in nuclear plants could be, well, inconsistent. Brown's Ferry 2002 helped accelerate its adoption across the fleet.
And adopting 70E meant big changes on the ground.
Two huge ones, primarily. First, ARC-rated personal protective equipment, PPE, became mandatory for most medium voltage work. We're talking specialized suits, hoods, gloves, layers, designed to withstand the intense heat of an arc flash for a critical fraction of a second.
Giving workers a fighting chance if the worst happens.
Right. And second, the widespread use of IE 1584 calculations. This standard provides methods to calculate the potential incident energy of an arc flash at specific points in the electrical system.
So you actually calculate the potential severity?
Yes. Plants had to undertake massive studies to analyze their switchgear, motor control centers, panel boards, calculate the potential arc flash energy measured in calories per square centimeter, determine the safe approach boundary, and then put labels on everything.
Labels telling workers exactly what hazard level they're facing and what PPE they need for that specific piece of equipment.
That's it. Hugely expensive and time-consuming effort, but it took the guesswork out. You know the risk before you even approach the gear.
Beyond PPE and labeling, did regulators or research groups like NRC and EPRI react?
They did. Events like this fueled more research into what are called high-energy arcing faults, or HEFs, understanding the physics better, understanding the impacts on surrounding equipment.
And that research led to?
It helped inform new design standards and encouraged plants to invest in things like arc-resistant switchgear gear, physically designed to channel the blast energy away from the front where workers might be, and also push for more remote operation capabilities, allowing operators to rack breakers in or out from a distance, completely removing them from the arc flash boundary.
So the core lesson, the big takeaway that you, the listener, should get from this LER is that a failure in what seems like basic industrial work can instantly become a test of the highest level nuclear safety systems.
That's the critical connection. You can't compartmentalize safety. An electrician's mistake grounding a breaker in the turbine building led directly to EDGs starting, RPS logic actuating, and ventilation systems isolating to protect the control room. The only things preventing a more severe outcome were those engineered backups, like the diesels, performing flawlessly. #outro.
Well, this deep dive certainly took us on a journey. From what seemed like a routine maintenance task during a quiet outage, to the absolute terror of a 35,000 degree arc flash in an instant, and then watching the plant's complex web of safety systems kick in exactly as designed. It's a powerful reminder that nuclear safety isn't just about managing the reactor core. It's about defending against all potential hazards, including these sudden, violent electrical ones.
It really underscores that threat, doesn't it? It can be instantaneous, purely electrical, and it hinges so critically on human performance, even during tasks that feel repetitive. That moment, the EDGs fired up, the control board lit up with isolations, it all traces back to that single lapse, that few inches of clearance not maintained. Vigilance, discipline, they really are the ultimate defense against these invisible dangers in the air.
And maybe we can leave you, the listener, with this thought to chew on. The LER makes it clear this arc flash happened just feet, maybe less, from energized critical equipment. The error itself was likely a matter of inches, given the unbelievable power unleashed in an arc flash.
Mm-hmm.
How close is too close? What happens when the only thing standing between a terrible industrial accident and a potential challenge to the entire plant's safety systems is the absolute precision of one person executing one step in a procedure? This event really proves that line can be incredibly thin.